Good evening. Welcome to the Critical Hour. We're coming to you from the capital of the United States of America, Washington, D.C., here on Radio Sputnik. I'm political scientist, author, and nationally syndicated columnist, Dr. Wilmer Leon. For the next 2 hours, I will explore and analyze the salient news stories that are impacting the global village in which we live. Yesterday, Wisconsin and Arizona certified their elections. Joe Biden won both states. Trump is running out of states, if he hasn't already, to continue his charade of court cases and vote challenges. In spite of all this, he has decided to pick a fight with one of his most loyal supporters, the Republican governor of Georgia, Brian Kemp, for being soft on voter fraud. This is not sitting well with rank-and-file Republicans and causing a great deal of concern and consternation within the party. For insight into this, we turn to our first guest. He's a political scientist and assistant professor of Africana Studies at DePaul University, Dr. Emmett Riley. As always, Emmett, welcome back.
Thanks for having me on. I appreciate it.
So before we get into the details of this, just your overall thoughts about the president's ongoing attempts to overturn this election. What do you really see as being his underlying motivation here? Because, you know, the man is crazy, but he's not stupid.
Right. I think that Trump's attempt to delegitimize the results of the election is simply his motive have always been, and that is to serve self. He's essentially upset with Governor Kemp because Governor Kemp will not interfere with the election that took place in Georgia. And so, I've talked a lot about Trump and his relationship to our institutions, American political institutions, and he essentially wants the governor to overturn a free and fair election. But I also think he's doing something else. I think he's sowing doubt on the election in an effort to keep his base motivated in the event that he decides to run in 2024. And I think this is very sad, but I also think if those people who know Brian Kemp and knew his behavior when Stacey Abrams ran against him for governor, knows that this man has a history of engaging in some of the systemic attempts to limit voting in majority black communities. And so I think that is the other element here, is that Donald Trump is all only interested in serving self. You would think that any other Republican president who has just lost re-election would utilize whatever political capital he have to motivate voters in Georgia to come out and vote so that his party could maintain control of the Senate. But we don't see that happening. And we don't see that happening is because Trump is only interested in serving Trump. And as long as he's interested in serving Trump, he doesn't care about the political leaders in his party. But I also think, too, this is exactly what Republicans deserve. They've gotten in bed with the devil, and now the devil is betraying them and attacking them. And this is a result of when you have a candidate like Trump who's only interested in serving himself and elevating himself.
You've launched into a number of things there. Hopefully I can keep them all in my head and address them one by one. First of all, to your point about his trying to be loyal to his base, that takes me back to Bill Clinton's statement years ago, it's better to be strong and wrong than weak and right. And I think that is resonating with a number of his constituents, because really what you want as a political constituent is your representative to fight for what it is you believe in. Of course, you always want to win, but if you don't win, you at least want to go down swinging. I think you're absolutely right on that point. To the point of serving self, you know, the Republican Party, in terms of their voter suppression tactics and approaches, you know, in something like this, you always have to operate on the margins. And in some instances, when you operate on the margins, you're gonna prevail. In other instances, mm-hmm. when you operate on the margins, you're going to come close, but no cigar. So, you know, they operated on the margins in 2000 and they won. They operated on the margins in 2016 and they won. This time it didn't work, but it doesn't, to your point, I go through all of that to say, I think that's just evidence of your point that the president is operating for self. And it's really, really odd, to your point, that he's attacking Brian Kemp, because Brian Kemp purged 340,134 voters falsely from the voter rolls in Georgia in 2018, asserting that these people had moved. So Brian Kemp did everything Brian Kemp could do. And it just didn't work this time.
He did everything he could do other than directly violate the law to tilt the election in Trump's favor. That is exactly why Trump is upset. He wanted Republicans to use everything in their power without respect for the rule of law, without respect for due process, without respect for the Constitution, to name him the winner of an election that he lost. Now, I personally believe that Trump knows he lost this election. I think that his attempts to continue to delegitimize the process is also an effort to get back at Democrats for their investigation of Russia and the impeachment proceedings. But I also think that because Trump does not understand the importance of how institutions work and how it impacts citizens, that he's doing more damage to the American public, because he's going to make it significantly more difficult for Joe Biden to govern. And also, we see these Republicans, too, who are just acting like Trump is the biggest bully in the world, where they're even afraid to say that Joe Biden is the president-elect, which, you know, this is unprecedented. But also, I think, too, let's be clear. Republicans are very strategic. State legislatures now are going to move in droves to limit vote by mail, to make voting more difficult. And I think that this lays the foundation for a number of Republican states to really move forward and with even more strenuous protections of making voting more difficult this coming year here. Because one of the things this election really showed is that when you make voting easy, people will vote. And people showed up and voted in alarming numbers. And that is not to say that our voting system is perfect, because we got a lot of work to do with in terms of securing voting. And I hope that that is Democrats' first order of business, is to secure voting rights in America for their own fate if they want to remain in power.
You know, when I hear all of these statements about how free and fair the election was, I say to myself and I say to those that are listening, oh, no, please don't be fooled by this outcome. Free and fair, this was not, because we had been saying, and I think I can include you in the we, mm-hmm. that it was going to take an incredible amount of turnout to offset the margins that the Republicans were operating on. So there were still millions of Americans who were disenfranchised. It's just that millions more turned out to offset those numbers. To your point about the institutions, Steve Bannon, and I say this all the time, and I know people are tired of hearing me say it, Steve Bannon, Trump's former advisor, said very early on in the game that it was their objective basically to undo the administrative state. And this, I think, is a perfect example of what overturning or undermining the administrative state actually means. And to your other point about Trump creating this whole imagery in the Republican Party, this to me goes all the way. This is the culmination of the Tea Party. This is the culmination of Tom Tancredo and We Want Our Country Back. This is the culmination of those Tea Party supporters standing on the lawn of the Capitol as John Lewis and Barney Frank were walking to vote and being called by these people everything but a child of God, and Mitch McConnell and Lindsey Graham gave absolutely no pushback to this because they realized this is their base.
Oh, I agree wholeheartedly with you. In fact, when we look back on this thing in hindsight, when these Tea Party Republicans were showing up in these districts shouting and cursing and talking about economic justice and the Constitution, at that time, remember, we have reached a point in America where certain things about race was unacceptable to say. And so when Trump emerged on the political scene in 2012 or 2011 about Obama not being a citizen, he became the vessel for them to now to use this racialized rhetoric and talk directly about race in a way that wasn't okay within the last 10 years. And so now it's coming home to roost because these people, the party now belongs to these people. And so we think about 74 million people who voted for Donald Trump despite all of his racial bigotry. And we also think about attempts by more mainstream Republicans understanding that this is their base. I think now more than ever, the movement that gave birth to the rise of a candidate like Donald Trump is going to be more of a threat than it ever has been. But I also think, too, we have got to engage in some real institutional reform where the Justice Department is completely independent of the presidency. We've got to talk about how do we secure voting rights, and imagine, too, that now we have a president, right, who really wants to direct political leaders to interfere in elections. And I think that this is almost mind blowing and comical. There is no way America can go around the world talking about democracy, anything, when we have a authoritarian leader here in America.
Talking again about Georgia and Trump's problems that he's causing, there's a runoff for two Senate seats in Georgia on January 5th. Senators Kelly Loeffler and David Perdue are in very, very, very close races. And Republicans now see that Trump is causing problems for them because he's urging supporters to not boycott the runoff election, but he's claiming that the process is fraudulent. In fact, Raffensperger, who's now the Secretary of State, said that some 24,000 Republicans who voted absentee in the June primary did not cast a ballot in the general election because they bought into Trump's rhetoric that the vote was insecure. So it could very well be that he's shooting himself in the foot here.
But I also think, too, when Trump first won re-election, I wrote a piece in The Hill where I talked about Trump as being ideologically schizophrenic. And what I meant by that is I don't think that Donald Trump is loyal to any political ideology. For example, Hillary Clinton, we knew that she stood where she stood on certain policy issues, even if she wasn't president. I think Trump is an opportunist, and he will embrace conservative ideas in so much as it serves his interests. Trump doesn't care about abortion, but it serves his electoral interests. He didn't care about the courts, but it served his electoral interests. And so now we see, really, he was only interested in remaining in power for the sake of remaining in power, because he has no loyalty whatsoever to the party, and he always goes back to. But I also think this is part of the larger conversation, right? Because the only areas that he really has issues in are majority black areas: Georgia, Philadelphia, Detroit. You know, these are issues where black voters showed up in an enormous way, and he has always demonized these majority black cities as crime infested, and so he continues to serve the interest of keeping his base engaged in this racialized politics, and also too understanding the way in which whites are now seeing their white racial identity under siege. It buys into let's continue to fuel fire. But again, how many enemies can you create in the party before the leadership steps up and say, you know what, we can't go down this route, you know? And so that's the unfortunate part. But we've always knew where Republicans stood on these issues. It's just that now they are being, you know, more explicit about it because it's the party of Trump.
Dr. Emmett Riley, as always, thank you so much for your time. We look forward to having you back.
All right. Thanks for having me.
You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. As we discussed yesterday, Dr. Mohsen Fakhrizadeh an Iranian nuclear scientist, was assassinated on Friday. It's now being reported that Iraqi sources told several Arab media outlets yesterday that an airstrike near the Iraqi-Syria border killed a commander in Iran's Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps. The strike reportedly occurred either late Saturday or early Sunday, and some accounts say it was a drone strike. Some of the sources identified the slain military leader as Muslim Shadan, a senior IRGC commander. Other reports say the IRGC commander could not be identified, but all counts say three other people were killed in the same event. The commander was reportedly struck in a vehicle that was entering Syria from Iraq. On the heels of the assassination of Dr. Fakhrizadeh, is this second story true, or is it PR to further heighten tensions? And we know tensions are rising and the stakes are getting high. For insight, we turn to our next guest. He's an investigative journalist and author of three books, The Frozen Republic, The Velvet Coup, and America's Undeclared War, Daniel Lazar. As always, Daniel, welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
We're also joined by broadcaster and journalist based in Beirut, Lebanon, Laith Maarouf. Laith, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
So, Laith, let me start with you. When I read this story about the second airstrike or the assassination via airstrike, I scratched my head and said, this one isn't sounding right. What are you hearing on the ground there in Lebanon?
None of the major media outlets that are counted in the Axis of Resistance, Al-Mayadeen Television, Press TV, or any other outlet that of repute here has reported this. And in fact, there has been statements of denial of any members of the IRGC being assassinated in Syria in the last 24 hours. And so what we need to be careful right now is that the fog of war has descended. There's been multiple reports of things that in the past 24 hours that indicated a beginning of hostilities that came out to be a false, including reports of attacks on oil installations in the UAE, the United Arab Emirates, and deployments of advanced air defenses in North Palestine and apartheid Israel. And so right now, definitely, we have to be careful. There's a lot of psychological warfare being circulated around.
Daniel Lazar, that takes me right to my next question, the psychological warfare element of this. Your thoughts on this story, and is it more probable than possible that this is a matter of really just trying to stoke the flames of unrest and on a psychological level?
Well, it's very difficult for me to comment from here in New York. I mean, I have no local sources, obviously. So as to whether it's possible or probable, I really can't say. I think the U.S. and Israel definitely want to sort of stay on the offensive. They want to throw Iran off balance, especially as the Trump administration enters its last, 6 or 7 weeks. And so Trump is interested in keeping the pot boiling. He may wish to even up the ante by somehow having a follow-up attack. I really don't know. But I think we're entering into a really tumultuous, crisis-filled period from now until January 20th.
Laith, to Daniel's point, tensions are rising. The stakes are getting higher. Iran says it's not taking the bait. Your thoughts?
I think Iran will be retaliating. The question is, when would it do it? Before Trump leaves and or wait until Biden is inaugurated? The question for them, you know, as Iran, is the fact that nothing will actually change. Whether it's Trump or Biden, the path of war has been drawn. because retaliation has to happen. Otherwise, Iran will have zero deterrence against its enemies, and the next assassination will be even a much more important person than either Soleimani, who was assassinated in January, or Fakhrizadeh, who was just assassinated as a scientist. So it is expected then the next targets would be somebody of the value of Hassan Nasrallah, the Secretary General of Hezbollah, or somebody within the higher ups of Iran itself in terms of a political structure. And therefore, Iran is in a situation where it has no choice but to retaliate in equal measure to create deterrence.
Daniel, to that point, the path of war has been drawn. As we look at the individuals that President-elect Biden is announcing that he wants to nominate to be in his cabinet, we're not, from the names that I've read and in the history that I understand, these folks aren't ones to turn away from a conflict. In fact, many of them have been responsible for fanning the flames in Libya, fanning the flames in Syria and other places. So your thoughts about who President-elect Biden is bringing into the game?
Well, he's bringing in Jake Sullivan as a national security advisor, and Sullivan was part of the negotiating team that hammered out the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear accord. So Sullivan has a stake in resurrecting that treaty, but I think the JCPOA is dead as a doornail, and I think that as your other guest says, the path of war has been opened. I think the fact that Biden has not said a word in the 4 or 5 days since the assassination is extremely telling. I mean, essentially, he recognizes that the JCPOA is a dead letter, and that Trump has sort of set the grounds for a confrontation that will likely take place on his, Biden's, watch. And Biden will have no choice but to follow the path laid out by Trump, ironically enough. So essentially, you know, Biden is condemned to carry out a Trumpian foreign policy. It's the height of irony, but that's what we see before us. I mean, Donald Trump is supposed to be on his way out, but somehow he is dictating policy to the incoming administration. I think that Iran's options at this point are very limited. It will strike back, I'm confident. But the fact is the preponderance of balance of power is just greatly against it, and it's very limited in what it can do.
Laith, your thoughts, as well as now with the assassination of Dr. Fakhrizadeh, and please forgive me for my butchering the pronunciation of his name. I'm doing the best that I absolutely can. That there's a debate going on within Iran between moderates and hardliners, between President Rouhani and hardliners. But I think it's a mistake for people in this country to think that debate is similar to what's going on here between Republicans and Democrats. That I would wonder if what's going on in Iran is really a debate about more form over substance, that there's not really a deviation, a very far deviation in terms of approach. Your thoughts?
So one thing to point here is that the first assassinations of Iranian nuclear scientists that happened in 2010 and 2012 were all under the Obama-Biden presidency and vice presidency. And so the people that were in that, you know, field of control in American foreign policy were the ones that started these assassinations. So therefore, Biden and his team are not against the assassination of Fakhrizadeh, and they will continue this policy if they are in power, which means that Iran And the people in Iran now understand 100% that there is no difference between a Democrat and a Republican president. And maybe all this game right now, and actually what Trump is doing by preparing a war for Biden, is to make it easy for Biden to blame it on him. It is the establishment itself in the United States playing this game. But Trump is not forcing anybody into anything. This was the path. The whole nuclear agreement was supposed to just slow down the development of Iran while the United States lays the ground for a war on Iran that it dreams that it can actually deliver on 100%. And, you know, whether it's Trump or Biden, the story is the same. And in terms of what's happening inside Iran, like every time I post about, you know, the assassinations or developments in Iran, people in Iran themselves are criticizing Rouhani, the prime president, and Zarif, the foreign minister, for dragging Iran through this, you know, almost 6 years of useless negotiations and agreement, and slowing down the development and allowing the United States to be ready for this war. So there is a lot of pressure on the Rouhani government, and in any upcoming elections, definitely the hardliners will win. But this is an internal issue of Iran about how much should they trust the West, and the West has shown that it cannot be trusted.
Just to quickly follow up, understanding the Supreme Leader, Khomeini, and the power that he has, that's really why I was saying I understand the pressures and I understand the differences, but the differences aren't really as great as a lot of people here would lead us to believe. Am I wrong?
You're not wrong at all. Of course, like the you know, the Ayatollah Khomeini has a final say on everything, and so the elected government had to get the approval of, you know, Khomeini.
That's the
and
point.
So they let them do it, and it didn't work out.
Okay. Daniel, your final thoughts.
Well, I mean, I agree with Lace to a degree, but I disagree with certain things. I mean, I think that Biden was quite sincere in wishing to resurrect the JCPOA, and I think there actually is a significant policy difference between him and Trump on this question. I mean, the Trump and Netanyahu's top priority was killing the JCPOA. Biden wanted to resurrect it, and now Trump and Netanyahu have won. The JCPOA is dead, and people like Rouhani in Iran have wound up looking foolish. But I do agree that the assassination of Fakhrizadeh has essentially joined the moderates and hardliners in Iran together. They have no choice but to fight back. As I said before, the JCPOA is a dead letter, and Iran at this point has got to defend itself against this growing U.S.-Israeli onslaught. And Iran's options are limited, but it just really can't not.
When you say, and I'm asking this because I really need you to elaborate, not to argue. When you say Iran's options are limited, what do you mean by that?
Well, I mean, militarily, the balance of power is just, you know, is just terribly lopsided. I mean, Israel has conducted literally thousands of airstrikes against pro-Iranian targets in Syria and Iraq with little fear of retribution. The USS Enterprise, the aircraft carrier group, just entered the Persian Gulf, and an aircraft carrier group, you know, packs extraordinary wallop. Now, Iran has carried out military exercises which involved attacking a U.S. Aircraft carrier, and I suppose it's conceivable. But if Iran ever did that, it would reap the whirlwind.
Late. Your thoughts, because Daniel's comment made me think of this. There was a kid that was bullying my son, and I told the kid don't ever mistake my son's unwillingness to kick your butt with his inability to kick your butt. Don't ever get the two confused. So, Laith, your thoughts to Daniel's point, and we got about a minute, we got to get out.
So, look, definitely the United States can destroy Iran. But mm-hmm. in the meanwhile, while that is happening, every American base and every floating base like aircraft carrier, every American vessel and their infrastructure from apartheid Israel to Saudi occupied Arabia to United Arab Emirates will be all wiped off the map in the meanwhile. And if the United States attacks the nuclear reactors of Iran, then the whole region will be living a nuclear winter of fallout from those nuclear reactors. So we have to calculate that. The United States knows mm-hmm. those facts. And anybody that's pushing the United States for war is actually asking for hundreds of thousands of American soldiers to come back in caskets. Yes, they will destroy Iran, but they will come back in caskets, in more caskets than the Vietnam War.
Daniel Lazar, Laith Maarouf, gentlemen, thank you both. Great analysis, great insight. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
Thank you. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's a very good piece in Mint Press entitled The Spin War, Superheroes and Nice Guys. Coverage of Biden's hawkish cabinet picks is predictably lacking. There's very little, if any, substantive analysis being provided in the mainstream about the people that President-elect Biden is nominating for his cabinet. Folks are waxing nostalgic about the good old Clinton and Obama days. Well, for insight into this, we turn to our next guest. He's the co-founder of Black Alliance for Peace and former vice presidential nominee for the Green Party. And he joins us to discuss his latest op-ed entitled U.S. Centrism, the Radical Betrayal of Global Solidarity. Ajamu Baraka, as always, welcome back.
Glad to be here. Thank you.
You open your piece, U.S. Centrism, the Radical Betrayal of Global Solidarity, with a quote from Dr. King from his book, Where Do We Go From Here, Chaos or Community, where he talks about how the government thingifies persons. Why did you think that quote about the thingification of human beings was appropriate?
Because the thingification of human beings, both in the U.S., but even more importantly, outside of the U.S., seems to have become normalized. That is, there are some communities that are seen as killable. That is, the members of those communities can have their rights trampled on, even to the extent of losing the most fundamental right they have, which is the right to life. And that seems to be all right. So people in the U.S. can complain about the possibility of Russian interference in their political processes, but support, and I have a mumbling critical word of a candidate, Joe Biden, who says that direct interference into the internal affairs of Venezuela, determining who would be the president, oh, that's all right. So, you know, in intervening and overthrowing governments, to determining who the leadership will be, to directly attacking governments. This seems to be a par for the course for U.S. policy, and that doesn't raise to the level of critique. So, you know, one can only conclude that the value of those lives outside in the colonized spaces really aren't the same as the value of white life. That's what I think Dr. King was getting at when he talked about the thingification of human beings.
And he writes, if you will thingify persons, you will exploit them economically. If you will exploit them economically, you will abuse your military power to protect your economic investment. And that point there takes me to ask you your thoughts on some of the names that the president-elect has now mentioned bringing into his cabinet, going back to, again, you will use your military power to protect your economic investments. There are a whole lot of chicken hawks that Joe Biden is bringing in, and they've already fumbled in Libya. They've already fumbled in Syria. They've already fumbled in Rwanda. And he seems to be bringing these fumblers back into the game.
Yes, and they seem to reflect the same kinds of values that Donald Trump had that everyone was opposed to. And that is, for example, his pick, Nero Tandon, for the Office of Management and Budget, clearly has the same kinds of approach that Donald Trump had when she said that not only should the U.S. attack and destroy Libya, but that they should steal the oil to take advantage of that situation and to address their budget deficits. Now, what is there? What's different about that position from the position of Donald Trump, who openly said that they were going to steal the oil of Syria? So this demonstrates once again that there are some objective interests in play here that does not really reflect any real principal differences between the two parties. Michelle Flournoy, who is supposed to be the Secretary of the Department of Defense, very, very similar kinds of principles, where she believes that U.S. military force is justified in maintaining a dominance over various trade routes. So the objective interests of the U.S. are to advance the notion of full spectrum dominance, the attempt by the U.S. to maintain their global dominance using military means, remains the central component of the Biden administration, which is also the central component of U.S. foreign policy for the last decade or more. So there's going to be a continuation of the same. In fact, it may even be more dangerous.
Not only full spectrum dominance, but totally ignoring the UN prohibitions on the use of military force, on the threat of the use of military force, and also being the unitary arbiter or determiner of when the force will be used. Just totally ignoring all other international norms and protocols.
Exactly. I mean, again, that was Michelle Flournoy's position, that the U.S. should not be constrained by multilateralism, by international law, that the U.S. had a right to project its power based on its own perceived needs. That, to me, Dr. Leon, is the definition of a rogue state. So the kind of rogue statism we saw under the Trump administration, people need to understand that that kind of rogue statism that we saw under Trump was also something we saw under Clinton and under Obama. It continues. And that's why we have to have a popular opposition to these policies. If not, then it's going to be a much more dangerous world for global humanity. And that's what I talked about in this piece that the Black Alliance for Peace put out, that basically we are undermining, we are failing the collective humanity by not engaging in effective opposition to U.S. warmongering, that we are undermining any attempt to establish solidarity among the oppressed when we remain silent to these kinds of gangsterous policies being articulated by both parties.
What about what I see as the failure of mainstream media to provide any substantive analysis of what it is that Biden or who it is that Biden is proposing? CNN has been incredibly deferential to his pick, saying that it's clear that Biden is choosing people who are indisputably experts in their fields. MSNBC talks about Biden's diversity of gender and race. Well, diversity of gender and race is an artificial construct, so we won't even really have to get into all that. But the identity politics that are being played here has really nothing to do with substantive policy analysis and substantive policy output. A black imperialist is no better than a white imperialist, and a white hegemon is no better than a black hegemon. I mean, it is what it is.
Exactly. But, you know, because of the use of what people refer to as identity politics, we're supposed to feel good about the fact that we have diversity in criminality. But again, looking at U.S. policies from the point of view of people in the global south, for example, it doesn't matter to them whether or not the person giving orders to drop bombs on them or a brother or whoever. All they know is that their families are being blown to bits and their communities and their nations destroyed. So these are the contradictions we have to deal with. We don't have the luxury of allowing for confusion and mystification to continue. People are losing their lives every day as a consequence of our silence and our collaboration with criminality.
So what are people to do now? I have been saying, and you've heard me say probably ad nauseum, that as important as November 3rd is, what really matters is what are you willing to do on November 4th and afterwards?
No, you're absolutely right. That basically now we have to have a more educated public. It troubles me how easily the public can be misled by some of the most crude and insulting propaganda that one can ever see. So we have to be more educated, more engaged, and we've got to be in the streets standing in solidarity with the people.
As always, Ajamu Baraka, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that input. We look forward to having you back.
I'm looking forward to the next time.
Thank you. You're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. NATO is to publish a report that calls for more focus on China. NATO is expected to have published a report today that says Russia will remain its adversary throughout this decade, but calls on the alliance to put more focus on China. The report titled NATO 2030 contains 138 proposals to reform NATO. Why? Why this? Why now? For insight, let's turn to our next guest. He's a peace activist, writer, and teacher, KJ No. As always, KJ, welcome back.
Great to be with you.
The report says China is no longer the benign trading partner that the West had hoped for. It is the rising power of our century, and NATO must adapt. A NATO diplomat that saw the report said this to a Reuters reporter. You know, that statement to me speaks volumes, and the word benign is what jumped out at me in terms of that statement. Your thoughts about my assessment, and I ask you, why this, why now?
It's an ongoing project. It really goes back to the 1992 Defense Guidance Planning document by Wolfowitz. This is the Wolfowitz Doctrine, and then the 1997 Project for a New American Century. Essentially, it's the understanding that China is a rising power and that the United States wants total global dominance. It cannot stand or brook a challenger to its total control of the world. So in 2011, we saw the Pacific pivot, and contemporaneous with that, or actually preceding it by a few years, was a battle doctrine marked out called air-sea battle. This was the Chinese equivalent of the NATO battle doctrine against the Soviet Union. That was called air-land battle. And in 2008, 2009, 2010, the U.S. prepared for war against China with air-sea battle. And then in 2018, they just came out and declared China and Russia enemies. They used the term revisionist power, but it means that these are official enemies that are challenging our dominance and control of the world. So the NATO as an arm or the attack dog of U.S. policy is simply, you know, following the dictates of its masters. And again, this notion that China is a threat, we have to understand that what Hillary Clinton said, that the mere existence of China is a threat because it didn't do what it was supposed to do. When it was brought into the global capitalist system, it was supposed to be a low-level producer of U.S. goods, a kind of a cheap workshop for U.S. Production. And at the same time, it was supposed to remain in a subordinate power. It didn't do that. It built up its own economy without war, without invasion, without colonization, without slavery, without primitive accumulation. And now it's big. It can no longer be bullied. And the bully, which is used to bullying, is stunned and surprised and frightened by this.
It's China is supposed to be what Japan was in the late 50s and early 60s.
Exactly. Japan, you know, was brought into the San Francisco system, but it was a very, very, subordinate partner. It did what the U.S. told it to do. The U.S. essentially set up, you know, its political system, its constitution, detailed the kind of four corners of its economy. When it started to step out of that, Japan was also taken down. If you remember the Plaza Accords of the 1990s, Japan went from one of the most powerful economies in the world to really a kind of a stagnant economy because the U.S. dismembered it unilaterally by forcing it to agree to these very, very punitive economic measures.
Unpack that a little more for me, because I'm old enough to remember in the 60s, late 60s, when Sony came on the scene. I remember, for example, when Made in China was the thing you did not want. And going from there, when the Sony Trinitron came on the scene, when the Sony radios came on the scene, when Datsun and Honda, when their cars and their lawnmowers came on the scene, and then all of a sudden they just decimated the American auto market. And then all of a sudden, to your point, in the 90s, one would have thought that Japan would be where China is now. But what happened to Japan that didn't happen to China? Does that make sense?
Yes, exactly. So Japan was a rising powerhouse. You mentioned Honda, also Toyota. You know,
right.
They were destroying the U.S. Market as well as, you know, I don't know if people recall this date, ages me, but, you know, the Sony Walkman, that was the thing.
Absolutely.
But clearly Japan was, the technological powerhouse. They were, you know, setting new standards in artificial intelligence, for example. They had a fifth generation AI project going on. And the U.S. decided that the Japanese had stepped out of their corner and they needed to be put back into place. So the Japanese were forced to sign a series of agreements largely relating to currency and currency trading relations. And what this did was it dismantled Japanese economic power. And eventually, Japan ended up with what's called, decades, the lost decade, but it was really decades of lost productivity. Japan is no longer, you know, the economic powerhouse that was expected in the late 80s and early 90s.
According to Reuters, this report that's supposed to be released today is suggesting that NATO should work closer with non-NATO countries like Australia. And all of this is calling for NATO to focus on deterring China in space. And this is it really seems to me as though the cat is already out of the bag, and that this really seems to be trying to rearrange the deck chairs on the Titanic, because I don't know how the United States and how NATO, even militarily, would be able to do what they seem to be claiming they want to do as it relates to China.
Yes, this is a really important development. And if you recall, the U.S. wants total domination in all warfighting domains. This includes air, land, sea, but also in space. And this goes back to a geostrategic theory, which understands that in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, the control of the planet was facilitated by control of the sea. The sea powers mm-hmm. control right. the world. It's understood that space serves that function now, so that in the late 20th, early 21st century, the power that controls space will control the rest of the world, just like sea power was dominant in the 20th century. And so because of this, the U.S. has created a space force. And again, this goes back to the 1997 Project for a New American Century. These are, you know, longstanding projects for global dominance. But as you point out, China is very, very advanced in aerospace. You know, they sent the first, you know, probe to the far side of the moon. You know,
I was just getting ready to mention that, because a lot of people dismissed, to me, or ignored the significance of being able to send a radio signal from the dark mm-hmm. side of the moon. It's yes, all about absolutely. Communication.
It's all about communication, and it shows the sheer level of technical prowess that the Chinese have. It's second to none in many areas. And this is why the United States, for example, is going after Huawei, because Huawei is one of the, you know, landmark companies in that. It shows how advanced Chinese tech is. And it's, you know, it has nothing to do with, anything borrowed or begged or stolen from the U.S. This is indigenous technology, and the Chinese are showing that they are peer competitors.
I had people say to me, Wilmer, who cares about that? Who cares about China being able to communicate with the dark side of the moon? And again, I'm old enough to remember when the Apollo program was going on, and there was a time during the day when Houston could not communicate with the astronauts because of where they were relative to the moon. And now China has solved that problem.
So, yes, again, you know, extraordinary kind of advancements. You know, they have a very, very robust space program. They had they've had various space stations and space flights. They mm-hmm. include a plan to have a permanent space station in a couple of years, and they want to send, you know, people to the moon. So it's, you know, while the U.S. has just kind of slowly kind of retreated from technology, a lot of American companies are tech companies, are really law firms or PR companies. They don't actually do the hard work of tech. But the Chinese are focusing on the tech, and they're really developing and breaking new ground. And that's why they cannot be ignored. Certainly, they cannot be charged with, you know, stealing this from the U.S. because they are more advanced. But also, it points to the fact that space is a warfighting domain. And that is one of the reasons why, you know, both China and the U.S. And NATO are involved in this kind of space race.
We only have about 2 minutes left. You mentioned PNAC, the Project for the New American Century. You mentioned the Wolfowitz Doctrine. When you look at the individuals or some of the individuals that Joe Biden is naming to his cabinet as a Democratic president, a lot of people think, oh, well, these are peaceniks. Oh, this is going to be a whole turnaround in American foreign policy, less aggressive stance, but nothing could be further from the truth because a number of the people that he's putting into his cabinet were involved with PNAC and some of these other conservative think tanks.
Oh, absolutely. So PNAC, you know, there's a rhyming or near rhyming counterpart to PNAC, which is CNAS, Center for a New American Security. And, you know, they say that history doesn't repeat itself, but it does rhyme. This is almost the rhyme of it. But yes, these people are neocons or neo-neocons, and they will continue the China bashing. They will grandfather in all the doctrines that Trump has instituted simply because these doctrines go back a long way. They go back to the late 90s, and they really have to do with this plan for U.S. global dominance and to shut out all competitors, including China. China is the enemy because it is challenging U.S. hegemony, not because it poses a threat, not because it has done anything untoward.
Well, in just 45 seconds, and we'll have to pick this up on the other side at another time, is it naive for me to trust the win-win strategy of China, that really what they're trying to do is grow their economy, grow their footprint, but they want both parties in an interaction to walk away winners?
You know, the Chinese have a long history. They've been around 4,000 or 5,000 years. And for about 2,000 years, they had something called Pax Sinica, which is essentially win-win relations with all countries. For 2,000 years, they had a non-expansive, non-invasive, non-competitive relationships with almost all of Asia and Eurasia. And so they're thinking over the long term. They're thinking if we do things right, if we stand within our center, within our integrity, we grow our economy and help the non-aligned countries without colonizing them, really just help them develop the way that we have developed ourselves, then we will be winners over the long term. So that's what they're trying to do. They're hoping the U.S. will come along and come to its senses. But we have so many ideologues who are so wedded to the idea of white supremacy and U.S. exceptionalism that it's going to be a hard upward battle. And we'll see if the Chinese leadership figures that one out.
I will ask my, as we get out, I will ask my audience this one question. When was the last time China invaded anybody? You got to think long and hard because you really got to know some history to answer that question. KJ, no. Am I right?
Yes. Well, 1978, they had a minor incursion with Vietnam, but that was in order to defend Cambodia because Vietnam had gone into Cambodia and was colonizing it. That's for another story.
Okay. KJ, no, thank you very much. Really, really appreciate it. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you so much. Always a pleasure.
Thank you. Folks, you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's another hour on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Well, COVID continues on the march, and here are the numbers for the United States for today. Total cases, we have 13.6 million total cases, up by 168,000 from yesterday. Unfortunately, 268,000 people have died. That's up by 1,265 deaths from yesterday. CDC advisors to vote today on who will be the first in line for a vaccine. The recommendations, if approved by the director of the CDC, will go to states. healthcare workers are expected to get top priority as debates intensify about the place of older Americans and frontline workers. What are we to make of all of this? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. She's a board certified pediatrician and obesity medicine specialist. She's on the faculty at the Milken School of Public Health at George Washington University, and she has a telemedicine practice called AskDrYola.com. She's Dr. Yolandra Hancock. Yolandra, as always, welcome back to the Critical Hour.
Thank you so much for having me, Dr. Leon.
So I find it interesting. There was no national testing strategy for the virus. That never came from the government. There was never a nationally led strategy for procuring protective equipment. States were basically thrown to the wolves and they had to fend for themselves. But today, a little-known federal advisory committee is expected to provide some of the most consequential directions to the states on this vaccine 10 months after the first case was reported in the country. Your thoughts on that?
I'm significantly concerned that this federal administration does not have a track record. I was going to say a solid track record, but they have no track record in terms of a national strategy for anything in the past 10 or so months of this pandemic. And in order for a vaccine effort to be pushed forth successfully, there has to be a coordinated effort led by evidence, science, and people with the experience. And what we know based on this administration is that they have not put people with experience and knowledge in these areas in positions of power. When you think through who led the COVID task force, all of these individuals, there were members who were evidence-based and highly experienced in the way of Dr. Fauci, but those who took the lead, were the voice, were not those of the experts. Instead, they were muzzled and threatened in terms of their job positioning. So my confidence is very weak in how this current administration is going to roll this program out when we know that there are issues in terms of cold chain, the logistics of actually having the vaccine in place, and then the administration of it. It's a Herculean task to create a vaccine program. It's the bread and butter of public health, but it requires expertise, skill, and no politics involved in order for it to be successful.
And to all of that that you just said, if you add this is a capitalist system, we know mm-hmm. that money and profit dictate and rule. We also know that in many regards, with the United States withdrawing from the World Health Organization's collaborative effort to develop a vaccine, that most of the focus for this seems to have been profit. So when you add that to the equation, it sends up antennas and raises the hair on the back of your neck and all the other references that one can conjure up to demonstrate how concerned one is about how this is all really going to roll out.
Absolutely. I think the fact that taxpayer dollars paid for the development in part for the Moderna vaccine, it should require that there is universal access to the vaccine once available. That's what good government should do.
What I didn't articulate was it's not only access once available, it's what's available, how much is available, because it makes me wonder, is there a actual intended short supply on the front end to maximize profit for as long as you can?
Absolutely. I would not be surprised when we know that the U.S. is attempting to purchase 600 million doses of this vaccine, because this vaccine requires a two-dose administration between 3 to 4 weeks apart. That's a heck of a price tag for this vaccine. And when we think through how vaccines are usually handled, right? Me as a physician, I'm required to purchase vaccines ahead of time and then bill insurance companies in order for the cost to be covered. And we're in a space now, Dr. Leon, where the cost of vaccines for physicians is so high that some pediatricians are no longer offering vaccines. That's how capitalistic this system has become. And although I love the Affordable Care Act, one of the things that it disallowed was healthcare professionals being able to charge to compensate for the cost not reimbursed by insurance. And so with the rollout of this vaccine, if it is not universally made available, what we're going to see is increased disparities and inequities within the rollout. Initially, it's going to go to those in highest need, our frontline healthcare workers, and deservedly so, and our elders. But once that happens, is it going to be a catch-as-catch-can where if you can afford it, you get it? What system is going to be in place so that we have universal and equitable access to this vaccine in the midst of a capitalistic system? And that's the other part that makes me very, very concerned.
And what role does the black market play in all of this when you, you know, are you going to come out of the metro one day and hey, psst, psst, hey, hey, I got that COVID. I got that COVID.
I got what you need. I got what you want. My name is Lene.
As we look at the next couple of weeks after the Thanksgiving holiday, Americans were begged it was to stay home. We were told what would happen if we didn't. But still, ignoring all of that, millions traveled, millions of people got together during Thanksgiving, and we know that it takes 2 to 3 weeks for us to see the impact, to see the numbers as a result of this activity. We saw that from Memorial Day. We saw that from Labor Day. We saw that from the 4th of July. Is this a tsunami on top of a tsunami that's about to hit?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. When the first full week of December, going into that second week of December, we were already breaking records at close to 200,000 new cases a day. And over 5 million people traveled around Thanksgiving time, just completely ignoring the recommendations of every single person in this country that is following these numbers. They decided they wanted to be with their boo, with their baby, and they're putting themselves, their family, at risk. And what we will see by the middle of December are numbers that we have not previously imagined. Doctors are saying, public health experts are saying, we are in a worse position now than we were at the peak of the pandemic back in March and April. And it's as if the threat to health, the healthcare system, the threat to healthcare workers means nothing to the American people.
And touch on how significant that is, because I'm very glad that you said that, because I don't think that a lot of people are looking at this as a systemic issue. We are so used to being sick and being able to go to the hospital and being able to get care, especially those of us that have health care or health insurance.
Right.
But this is now going to become, if it hasn't, and it has already in some states, a situation where the system cannot handle your problem.
Absolutely. Absolutely. We're looking at the country right now in certain states where they're at 80, 90% capacity now, before we see the consequences of this Thanksgiving travel. I have colleagues who are in positions of administration, and they have to tell the frontline workers, even in the face of testing positive for COVID, if you don't have symptoms, you are still compelled to show up for work. Can you imagine knowing you have COVID-19, stressed out because you're taking care of patients with COVID-19 and being told you have to show up for work? And imagine that you haven't tested positive, but you're around colleagues who are. Like, this is where we are. Bed capacity is filling up, and you're asking nurses, doctors, nurse practitioners, and physician assistants to show up with COVID so that patients can be seen. And then we're telling the American people, trust the healthcare system. Still come in for your checkups. Still come in for your chest pain, knowing that the mandate is for physicians and other healthcare professionals to show up with COVID. Like, where are we, where we are expecting our frontline workers to show up with the virus and work to their capacity when we know that their mental health is exhausted, their physical health is exhausted, and we're expecting them to not get sick in the midst of all of this mess with having tested positive for COVID? Like, that's what really breaks my heart and blows my mind, is that again, you call us heroes, but then what do? You don't take any steps personally to make sure that your healthcare heroes are protected. It's a slap in our faces, and it's heartbreaking for us collectively.
There is a article in Common Dreams entitled "Housing is Healthcare: Evictions Have Exacerbated COVID-19 Pandemic," according to a study It says there's no way for a vaccine to be successful without addressing the eviction crisis. That's how housing justice advocate Emily Benfer, a law professor at Wake Forest University, put it when describing her research, which found that premature expiration of state eviction bans has led to more than 433,000 excess COVID-19 cases and 10,700 preventable deaths in the United States between March and September. I know you haven't had a chance to read the study, but your thoughts on the premise.
Right. I don't have to read the study to have a clear understanding that this is a reflection of what we've talked about before. The social determinants of health, those factors where you are born, grow, learn, live, work, play, pray, and age, that influence 80% of your health outcomes. So if I'm threatened with the loss of housing, the stress by itself impairs my immune system. Therefore, when I am possibly exposed to COVID, I'm at higher risk. And then if I find myself in a homeless situation and you have multiple families living in the same household, you end up homeless and in a shelter. How are you supposed to protect yourself from coming into contact with other individuals, number one? Number two, how are you supposed to maintain your personal space in order to stay masked up, keep your mask clean, make sure you're protecting your family? And then third, if and when you develop COVID-19, how are you supposed to self-isolate and quarantine for 14 days when you do not have a protected place in which to live? It's compounding the impact that this pandemic has had, particularly on communities of color, because those eviction notices are going to disproportionately impact Black and brown communities. And we already are dealing with an unequal, uneven number of us dealing with COVID-19. All this is going to do is further impact the prevalence and incidence of COVID within Black and brown communities and lead to higher levels of morbidity and mortality. It just speaks to why all of this interconnects as one continuous system. Housing, food access, access to health care, all of those directly influence our risk of COVID. It isn't just diabetes and high blood pressure. That's a small part of what puts us at higher risk for contracting and then dying from COVID-19. And I commend her for calling it as it is, because if we don't take steps to protect people from eviction right now, we haven't even imagined what we're going to see come January with the level of stress, desperation, and illness as a result of us not acting ahead of time.
And we still haven't gotten to Christmas. And so what we're experiencing or what we anticipate to be experiencing in another 2 weeks around the 15th of December, mm-hmm. we still haven't gotten to the 25th yet. So and New Year's. So Dr. Yolandra Hancock, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. Is the Trump administration showering Saudi Arabia with last-minute gifts? This is the title of a great piece in Mint Press News, and it reads, while the administration of Donald Trump readies its exit from the White House and the Middle East, Saudi Arabia's use of American diplomatic cover and weapons alike has taken a fevered pace as the kingdom deepens the tragedy it has afflicted upon Yemen, where millions of forgotten people are struggling against a cold winter, starvation, epidemics, and the worst blockade in the modern era. What are we to make of this? Well, for insight, we turn to our next guest. She's a leading lawyer, consultant, strategist, communications expert. She was the founding editor-in-chief of online magazine Inside Arabia and is currently the democracy lead at Democrats Abroad Morocco. She is Elizabeth Myers. As always, Elizabeth, welcome back to The Critical Hour.
Thank you very much for having me, Wilmer. Glad to be here.
So on Friday, Saudi warplanes struck populated neighborhoods in Sana'a with at least 20 airstrikes One person was killed and dozens were injured. A number of purebred horses were killed. Airstrikes, they hit government buildings, water pumps. Talk about what seems to be an escalation here and why.
I don't know that this is an escalation. I think this is a continuation of basically 5 years of airstrikes that have targeted civilian targets. I mean, why target a school, a military college, you know, unless there's intelligence information that it's housing weaponry or something, and kill Arabian horses? Why target the water systems? Why target the school buses? This is just a long line of abuses that violate the right of war that the Saudi and Emirati-led coalition has been wreaking on the country since 2015. So I don't see this as an escalation. Perhaps one of the differences that I do see is that as this war goes along, the Houthis, who are the Yemeni rebels, they're Yemeni people. They're not an outside terrorist organization that has come in to try and infiltrate. They are Yemenis who rose up in 2014 against what they perceived as a corrupt government. They are increasingly gaining capability to produce missiles and other weaponry in the country or locally. And they have demonstrated over the last year or so that they can actually reach Saudi Arabian territory. And indeed, about a year and a half ago, when they hit the oil fields and crippled Saudi Aramco for a period of time, the level of danger that I think Saudi, the kingdom perceives has grown. But what the coalition has done, I don't see that as an escalation. They've been doing it all along.
Talk a little bit more about the Houthis and their striking back, because and also, you know, we always hear the reference made, the Iranian-backed Houthis. And that is supposed to, I guess, convey some sort of rationale or justification for Saudi Arabia attacking Yemen. But what we're seeing now, to your point, with the Yemeni or the Houthi returning fire, these Quds two-winged missiles, much more precision strikes, one wonders, where are the Houthis getting their technology from?
Well, I can tell you that part of their technology has come from U.S. weaponry that they have either not discovered, but when it has not been exploded, they have used it to start to learn from that technology.
And reverse engineered it.
Yeah, exactly. There's been that. Of course, there has been Iranian weaponry provided as well. But to just kind of try and undermine their legitimacy as Yemenis seeking justice or a new path for Yemen with a less corrupt government, it doesn't fly just to say that it's a proxy war. It's not that simple. And there are many, as I've said on many shows before, there are a number of parties involved in this war, but the overarching, most horrendous part of it has been the coalition that started out as 9 Arab countries led by Saudi Arabia and the UAE in just wreaking havoc on the people, on the civilians, on the infrastructure, destroying healthcare facilities, and really making it impossible for the people who live there, especially in the north, to live their lives. I think some of the worst impacts have been on the women and children. They're undergoing now what's been called the worst famine in 100 years in the world. In April of 2018, the UN Secretary General called it the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and I know you always insert man-made, and that's absolutely correct. And that was two years ago, more than 2.5 years ago, and it's just getting worse. And at some point, it has to come to an end. And I'm very hopeful. Maybe I'm getting ahead of myself here, ahead of you, but I'm hopeful that with the new administration, with the new Secretary of State that's been announced earlier this week, that there will be an opportunity to stop our U.S. aid of this devastation?
Well, that was a question that I had for you, because when you look at the history and the record of a number of the people that President-elect Biden is nominating to his cabinet, he's nominating some of the very people who were responsible for greenlighting these atrocities during the Obama administration. So it makes me wonder, what different mindset are they bringing to the game now that they didn't have when they helped the Saudis start this attack?
You are absolutely correct. The newly announced Secretary of State, incoming Secretary of State Tony Blinken, in fact, was one of agreed with some of the biggest foreign policy mistakes that the Biden and that the Obama administration made with Biden as vice president, including Syria and Libya.
Well, I think he goes all the way. I think it's Tony Blinken that goes all the way back to when Biden was in the Senate and helped sell the Iraq War.
Iraq War. It's true. And he was initially a defender and advocate for the U.S. support of the Saudi coalition in the war in Yemen. However, that was 5 years ago, before our support contributed to the creation of the world's worst humanitarian crisis. And it's possible that he has now learned from that mistake, because we did see in 2018, he was one of the leading former Obama administration officials who signed a letter in support of the effort to end U.S. involvement in the war and support of the War Powers Resolution that the Congress passed almost unanimously, that the Trump administration simply ignored. So there are some who believe that there's good reason to expect that with Blinken's change position, there may be action early on in the Biden administration to withdraw. And I hope that means that there will be a clean break with the errors of both the Obama and Trump administrations with respect to Yemen.
And one of the things, to your point, that could be an element or a contributor to change, 80 organizations joined together yesterday, signing a letter requesting and demanding, urging that President-elect Joe Biden and his administration put an end to the support for this devastating war. That letter coming from Code Pink. And so more public attention brought to these atrocities could go a very long way.
Well, I think so. And that's certainly one thing that when I was editor-in-chief of Inside Arabia, we really tried to do that with our Save Yemen campaign that was all over the buses in New York City when it was meeting for the General Assembly. And I think the coalition of organizations that have signed this is very impressive, including, I will note, the new Democracy for the Middle East Now, Dawn, that was the brainchild of Jamal Khashoggi. And I really subscribe to the philosophy that he had in starting this. And then after his death, a group of friends have brought it to life and launched it as of September this year. But his philosophy was that democracy and human rights are the only things that are going to bring peace to the MENA region. And I think that is so true. And hopefully the elevation of awareness of this so-called hidden war will help to turn things around there.
You know, you mentioned the P word, peace, and everybody says they want it, but the United States seems to only want it a certain way, through a certain process, and that means through military strength. As even Biden said in his first address as president-elect, he said, we're going to use the example of our power, and if that doesn't work, the power of our example. And I think he got that backwards. I think we need to use the power of our example, and if that doesn't work, then the power of our force.
Well, I think that's consistent with the message that I heard him give in person in 2014 and in Marrakesh when we had the Global Entrepreneurship Summit, and he gave his birthday speech at this event before thousands of people. And that was really the message, the power of our example and our soft power of moral persuasion. But we have to have the high ground on morality first. And in this one, we simply can't. And I'm afraid that also the Trump administration has been the worst example of the lack of morality, because the last dart that Trump is going to throw, apparently, in this war is to try and designate the Houthis as a terrorist organization. And that is going to have even worse ramifications for the country and the civilians in terms of inability to continuing and worse inability to get humanitarian aid and other things that they need just to survive.
We have just about 2 minutes left. If Trump were to do that, I believe that would be through executive order. What would it take then for President-elect Biden or President Biden on the 20th of January to immediately reverse that and start to demonstrate that he actually understands that this is a humanitarian issue? This is not really a military issue.
Actually, it is something that the Secretary of State issues a designation, and it can be reversed or revoked by the same Secretary of State or by a subsequent Secretary of State. Also, Congress could revoke it, or it could be revoked by a court order. So there are numerous pathways for it to be revoked if the Congress were to enact another War Powers Resolution, although I don't think it's going to need to this time, then certainly it could, in conjunction with that, if necessary, revoke any order issued by any designation issued by Secretary of State Pompeo along that score as well.
Really quickly, do you see this as an issue that's at the top of Joe Biden's list?
No, I don't. But I see it, these AT organizations and the continuing public pressure, I think, that can be brought to bear will push it up there a little bit. It's not a difficult thing to reverse course on this. So hopefully by virtue of getting it more prevalently, and we've seen the campaign platform was to reverse U.S. policy in supporting the war in Yemen. So I'm hoping that with this more high profile pressure, that it will be there and make a difference.
And since this actually was initiated under the Obama administration and Joe Biden was Obama's vice president, it's not as though President Biden won't know anything about the issue. Elizabeth Myers, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. We look forward to having you back.
My pleasure, Wilmer. Thanks again.
Thank you. You're listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. I'm Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. Venezuelan opposition envoy quits as anti-Maduro coalition phrase. Venezuelan opposition leader Juan Guaido's diplomatic envoy to the UK has resigned from her post in the latest sign of trouble for the fractious Western-backed coalition trying to unseat President Maduro. All of this as parliamentary elections are scheduled to be held in Venezuela on Sunday, December 6th. What does this really say for the future of this attempted coup? Well, we turn to our next guest. He's a peace activist and author of Blood on Our Hands, The American Invasion of Iraq, Nick Davies. Nick, as always, welcome back.
Yeah. Hi, Wilmer. Thanks for having me again.
Thank you so much for joining me. So this UK envoy, Vanessa Newman, told the Financial Times that she had quit because of doubts within the opposition over Guaido's future, concerns over strategy, and dismay over the bureaucratic delays in Washington to the release of frozen Venezuelan government funds held in the U.S. to the opposition. She said the fight against Maduro will continue and she'll probably or personally continue to fight. Your thoughts on, is this a bigger signal than most folks want to admit?
Yeah, I would say so. I mean, this, you know, there are several things here that are worth noting. You know, the fact that, you know, the Venezuelan opposition had seemingly united around, you know, the U.S.'s choice of Juan Guaido to somehow try and overthrow the government there and put Juan Guaido in power. And, you know, really, this has clearly failed. And the opposition is now fracturing. And, you know, hopefully this will mark the end of this very, you know, just incredibly strange U.S. regime change effort in Venezuela. And the fact, I mean, another notable point here is that, you know, the U.S. backing to Guaido and his colleagues clearly was not as clear and as unequivocal as they presented it to the world. The fact that they never turned over all that money, all the frozen Venezuelan funds to Guaido and his colleagues, like this lady in London, the whole thing has really just been a mess from start to finish, and so, you know, really, you know, maybe even in these final days of Trump, where things are very unpredictable in terms of Trump causing more trouble all over the world, you know, we can hope that this chapter is coming to an end, and that you know, the people of Venezuela will be able to, you know, vote in an election and another election, because they've already voted in many elections.
You said, Nick, that the opposition is fracturing, and that's, I got you there. But what you say the chapter is closing, what does the U.S. do? Global hegemons tend not to go quietly into the night. And one of the things that I would look at as a comparison, and just at a 30,000 foot level, because I know that there are very intricate differences, but look at Iran. The Shah collapsed. The U.S. lost. But 30 years later, 40 years later, we're still trying to overthrow the democratically elected theocracy in Iran. So it is hard for me to see the United States tucking its tail between its legs and going back into its burrow.
Yeah. Oh, for sure. Yeah. That's absolutely true, Wilmer. But at the same time, this particular effort, you know, involving Juan Guaido and these, you know, horrendous sanctions that the U.S. has imposed. I mean, hopefully the Biden administration will come in and with enough public pressure be forced to rethink an awful lot of this. You know, it remains to be seen. It's going to take a lot to, you know, right now the U.S. has these, you know, crushing sanctions against Iran and Venezuela. The U.S. has some form of sanctions now against affecting one third of the world's population. You know, more than 2 billion people around the world. You know, it has some sanctions on China, some sanctions on Russia, and, you know, and still sanctions on countries like Syria. And I mean, wherever it perceives an enemy, you know, it rolls out these sanctions. And you know, here we are in the middle of a pandemic, You know, and the U.S. is preventing the import of vital medicines to countries around the world. I mean, this is just absolutely brutal policy. You know, sanctions. You know, okay, maybe. You know, we should be stronger in opposing, you know, actual bombing campaigns. You know, the literally, you know, drop bombs and rip people's bodies to shreds, men, women, and children. But sanctions are not a peaceful or nonviolent alternative to that. Sanctions.
Nor are they effective.
Or are they effective? I mean, there are very good studies that have looked at historically at the use of economic sanctions to achieve political changes in other countries. Robert Pape conducted a great survey of these in the 1990s, and he concluded that in only 4% of cases have economic sanctions been successful in changing other countries' politics. And so, in fact, as he kind of concluded from that, you know, that's not really the objective. What these sanctions do, you know, apart from just punishing the people for electing the quote-unquote wrong government from the United States perspective, they also help to set the stage for war and to set the stage for coups and covert action and all the other arsenal of U.S. weapons to attack other countries, you know. And by saying that, well, we tried sanctions and they didn't work, that then becomes a sort of implicit justification for all the other things that are even worse.
You know, I didn't really have to go to Iran and to the Shah and the overthrow of the Shah to find a comparison for Ms. Newman's quitting her job and your point about the opposition is fracturing, because we can put this in a much clearer historical context in terms of America's policy towards Latin America. And 45 years ago, Operation Condor, the global campaign of violent repression against the Latin American left. And we now see a resurgence of that left. So we have just a couple of minutes. If you could put this in terms of a historical context, in terms of what happened in Chile and how, again, the United States doesn't go quietly into the night. When it's trying to overthrow you, they usually don't just lose and leave.
Yeah, I would refer your listeners to, you know, a great piece in Jacobin by Branko Marcetic, and it's called The CIA's Secret Global War Against the Left. And it really, this is a brilliant, you know, comprehensive piece about Operation Condor. And frankly, Wilmer, this is personal to me. One of my best friend's brothers was disappeared and almost tortured to death in Argentina. He was missing for a year, until in the middle of the night he was dumped back on his parents' front porch. He spent months in hospital. You know, all they could do, I mean, they had to get dentists to remove what were left of his teeth, surgeons to remove what were left of his genitals. He never fully got his hearing back after spending weeks on end with headphones blasting loud music duct taped to his head. His name was Daniel. And he eventually became an exemplary citizen. He recovered. He went back to school. He became an IT professional. He tutored street kids in Mendoza. He ended up adopting several of them and raising them as his own kids. Obviously, he couldn't have his own kids after what they did to him. But then, you know, eventually it all caught up with him, and very sadly, he, as far as anybody knows, and there's even doubts about that, but he eventually took his own life.
Was the United States, was there any evidence that the United States was involved in his disappearance and or torture?
Well, the United States was involved in, as, you know, as Branko Marketic documents so well in his article, the United States was involved in all of it, all the mm-hmm. disappearance and torture and you know, brutal killings of thousands mm-hmm. and thousands of people in Argentina, Chile, Uruguay, Brazil, across Latin America. You know, and in a sense, part of why the story on Venezuela is hopeful in that we see, you know, today the U.S. failing to establish such a comprehensive reign mm-hmm. of terror across that continent. So that is cause for hope. We have, look what happened in Bolivia. You know, after a coup only a year right. ago, you know, the mass party of Evo Morales, you know, has come back mm-hmm. and forced a new election, you know, by launching a general strike against the coup government. You know, they eventually forced it to hold an election, and they won and have been returned to, you know, the legitimate government of Bolivia has been restored.
Hopefully, in what we pray for and what we fight for is that it can be sustained. That is what we hope and pray for, both there and in Venezuela. Nick Davies, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis, and we look forward to having you back.
Thank you for having me, Wilmer.
Thank you. You are listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's more on the other side. Stay tuned. We are back, and you're listening to The Critical Hour on Radio Sputnik. I'm your host, Dr. Wilmer Leon. There's a great piece in Common Dreams entitled Housing is Healthcare. Evictions have exacerbated COVID-19 pandemic, research shows. This is a time where it's not an overstatement to say that for many people, eviction can lead to death. Is this alarmist rhetoric, or is this the alarm or wake-up call to a growing American problem? For insight into this, we turn to our next guest. He's an associate professor of economics at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, Dr. Linwood Taheed. As always, Linwood, welcome back.
Thank you, sir.
It says Emily Benfer, the law professor at Wake Forest who did this research, she says, there is no way for a vaccine to be successful without addressing the eviction crisis. Your thoughts, Dr. Linwood Taheed?
No, I think her research points out raises an important alarm. I mean, it's not alarmist. It is raising an alarm that we have to understand that things are connected to other things. It's not just that the COVID crisis has affected the economy in a way that has eliminated income for many people or reduced income so that they can't pay their rents or pay their mortgages. It's the fact also that them being evicted from their homes or apartments is going to, in fact, exacerbate the coronavirus impact. Which will then further exacerbate or affect the economy and further more evictions and foreclosures. What we have here in what economists and other social scientists call is a vicious cycle where a bad outcome in one area causes a bad outcome in another area, and the bad outcome in that area goes back and reinforces the first bad outcome. This is also known as a death spiral. We are just with housing and COVID, we are heading into a situation that will be very well to which there is no solution, I would argue, except federal government intervention, which, as we know, is probably not forthcoming for a while.
You know, you mentioned the death spiral, and as a policy person, I always looked at this from what I call the multidisciplinary approach. And the example that I use when I was talking to political candidates or whatever is a rodent problem. People can view rats as a rat problem, but rats have fleas. Fleas bite people. That becomes a health problem. Rats gnaw on wires and gnats raw on concrete, and that becomes a infrastructure problem. And they are unsightly, so that becomes a tourist problem. So there are a lot of different issues that can come from what is thought to be one problem. And you can look at the eviction crisis as an eviction crisis, but in the midst of a pandemic, it is much, much, much more than that. Emily Benfer writes, she's a housing advocate and a law professor at Wake Forest. She found that premature expiration of state eviction bans has led to more than 433,000 excess COVID-19 cases and 10,700 preventable deaths between March and September. So not only does she have a theory, but she also quantifies this. I mean, her research puts some numbers on the theory.
Exactly. It's research. This is not just speculation. This is analysis of data, which indicates an effect of evictions and foreclosures, which we would expect to happen. I mean, look, the CDC had a moratorium, or at least advised on a moratorium on evictions from a healthcare point of view, arguing that evictions would put people out of their homes, which means they have to live somewhere else. They're going to live with other persons, which would cause an increase in, let's say, occupancy for homes and apartments, which would lead to further contagion for coronavirus, an atmosphere of contagion. And persons who are homeless, who are perhaps living in homeless shelters, or are going to, that's a mass of people. Some of whom are going to be infected, and they're going to infect others. Social distancing goes out of the way. In addition, persons who are not in their homes because they can't pay their rent or mortgages probably also are not able to buy food to keep themselves healthy, to keep their immune system going. You're right. This is a multidisciplinary problem. But we are so used to thinking of things in a kind of a one-on-one type of situation, without understanding that this is a complex society, and pretty much everything is connected to everything else. There's one thing important. I looked at the numbers from her report, the Lisa report out, and it says that mortality rate was 5.4 times higher among those who had been evicted. And that struck me, because the mortality rate for COVID-19 has been going down. It was going down, probably because of healthcare professionals better able to deal with the symptoms and learning about treatment. Mm-hmm. But the average mortality rate is 1.7%. Among these folks, it's 5.4%, which is three times what that general mortality rate is. So I mean, not only are they dying, they're dying at a faster rate than the general population infected by COVID.
And, to your point about being evicted and then having to move into other types of housing, all of that in terms of COVID gets exacerbated because it's an airborne virus. So it's much more easily transmitted through coughing and sneezing, and now we're getting into winter, the temperatures are dropping. This is really going to be compounded. There was another study, 12 million to lose federal unemployment benefits after Christmas. 12 million people would lose benefits the day after Christmas if Congress does not pass extensions for key unemployment programs. This is according to the Century Foundation, which is a progressive think tank. And one would think if Congress were to take the multidisciplinary approach to dealing with this issue, there really shouldn't be any debate.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. There's obviously has to be an extension of these federal unemployment benefits. But it's even worse than that. Look, there was a survey that was done of expected expenditure during the Christmas season from households. Mm-hmm. And that number came out that households were expecting to spend about $500 on average for Christmas. Last year, the number was $1,000. So this year, households are expected to spend half of what they were expected to spend, what they actually spent last year. I would imagine that persons who were going to lose their federal unemployment benefits were not going to go out and spend money for Christmas if they're going to lose those benefits after Christmas. So if you want a boost for Christmas, then you extend those federal unemployment benefits now, so that people will say, well, okay, at least after Christmas I'll have some income, so maybe I can spend a little more. It's probably not going to go up to what it was last year, but if it's not there, then the economy is going to collapse. We've just gone through Black Friday. Well, Black Friday is named Black Friday because it is the day on which the average retailer in the U.S. goes into the black as they mm-hmm. begin to make a profit for the year. I suspect that most retailers, that the average retailer is still going to be in the red by the end of the year. This is a tremendous death spiral effect on this economy, and we will not get out of this unless we spend federal money. And the longer we wait, the worse it will be.
Your thoughts on some of those that President-elect Biden has named to his economic team, starting with Janet Yellen. There are those who make the point that when you look across the board at the names of the folks, many of them aren't, that they're all policy wonks. Very few of them are politicos. And the logic that I see there is Biden's the politico. Trump needed Mnuchin because Trump is not politically savvy. Biden doesn't need politically savvy people because he's the political sav. So that's just a tangential point to the initial question. Your thoughts on his economic team?
Well, what I see in his financial team are people who are what we call deficit hawks. Now, Janet Yellen doesn't really fit that, but the manager of the the nominee
OMB
for OMB. Neera Tanden, right?
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Neera Tanden is very much a policy wonk. In fact, she's not she's not an economist. She's a lawyer. Mm-hmm. OMB is a very much an economic oriented organization, and OMB is also the gatekeeper for spending money. That is, if the government, if the executive branch, let's say, decides they want to spend money, the OMB gets to score how much that's going to cost the government. And if you are a deficit hawk, then you get to say, as the director of OMB, no, we can't do this. Mm-hmm. OMB's in opinion on that is very much, in fact, in law. The respected opinion in terms of what the administration can put forward. So Janet Yellen is someone, of course, who knows that we need to spend money to get out of this economic situation. But even her opinion, if she decided to go that way, could be overruled by a deficit hawk person in the OMB. Neera Tanden is also someone who has argued that we need to start reducing Social Security benefits because we're mm-hmm. going to have money. And so even if the money is spent in an emergency situation, then what you can expect is that austerity will be what will be argued by the Biden administration after that. And that austerity means we spent so much money to fight COVID. Now we don't have enough money for Social Security, so we'll have to reduce that. That's the game plan that I can see from the economic team that he's putting together.
That's not a very positive game plan. In fact, I'm comforted in being able to say I see it the same way. And if I see it the way you see it, then I think I'm probably right. But that's not a good sign for where we are right now. We got about 45 seconds.
It's not a good sign. Just getting over COVID is not going to get this back to where it needs to go. We've lost so much production. People who will be, let's say we get the economy back to where it was in terms of employment before. Well, there are persons who have been out of work with zero or no income for months who are behind on their rent, behind on their mortgages. They will not be able to catch up just going back to business as usual. And you can't expect the private sector to say, you know, well, I laid you off 3 months ago. I know you have three months of bills. Here's 3 months of extra pay.
Right.
That's not going to happen. The only place that can happen is that government has to spend it. And the idea that you can, for example, reduce Social Security to those who are retired and still maintain a vigorous economy is wrong. Once you start reducing income to elders or to persons on Social Security, they stop spending money because they don't have it in the economy.
It doesn't come from any other source.
That's right.
Dr. Linwood Tahid, as always, thank you so much for your time. Really appreciate that analysis. Look forward to having you back.
Thank you, sir.
Folks, you've been listening to The Critical Hour here on Radio Sputnik. Thank you for allowing my voice into your space. I hope you were informed and enlightened. I look forward to talking with you right here tomorrow on Radio Sputnik. Be safe. Practice physical distancing. COVID is on the rampage. Peace and blessings. I'm out.